They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Crossover NBA Podcast. On this episode, we're going to get to the Toronto Raptors taking a 2-1 series lead over the Warriors in the NBA Finals. Also want to talk a little bit about Kyrie Irving, the latest evolution in his gossip, everything surrounding him. The Pelicans starting to listen to offers involving Anthony Davis. We'll get into that and much more on this week's show. As always, best way to support this podcast, head over to Apple Podcasts where you can post a rating or leave a comment. Maybe you can do both. It's easy. It's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. Also, if you like boxing, subscribe to the SI Boxing Podcast hosted by yours truly. That podcast also comes out every week. And finally, In the Paint on SI TV every single week, new episodes every week. This week, we've got a great panel discussion. We've got a great guest, John Rothstein, who is our NBA draft analyst. He joins the show to talk about the draft only a couple of weeks away. Just a great overall show that you can catch on SI TV. To subscribe, go over to SI.TV. All right, joining me now from New York, where we did not attend Game 4 of the NBA Finals, but we'll get there at some point. Rohan Nadkarni, the staff writer over at SI. What's up, man?
So, Chris, I have two housekeeping things I want to hit today.
See, this is what you do. Like, every time we go into a show, I feel like you have something early
to
say.
Yeah, I just got a couple. Just like to let the audience
get
in,
it off
kind of behind
chest.
The scenes. Okay, number one, we're recording this early in the morning for me, as you know.
Okay, it's not early in the morning.
That's not an issue. I did go to a bodega to get coffee, however, and I think the milk that they had was the milk that they had out yesterday. So it's a little dicey as to what's going to happen to me. Number two, we're in a room that had a sign on the door that said, do not close. And that door doesn't have a handle on it. So I don't know how we're going to get out of here. We might be stuck in this room forever.
I just realized
that.
Yeah. Nobody told me. Okay.
Yeah, well, we'll find out. We'll just have to knock.
Against the glass like we're prisoners. Exactly. That's unfortunate. That's unfortunate. I feel like I'm going to take a picture of that before we leave and post it for the podcast.
There we go.
Audience. But that's a problem for 25, 30 minutes from now.
So quick housekeeping notes. That was it.
Fair enough. All right. So your reaction to game three, the Warriors, they come out without Klay Thompson, no Kevin Durant, no Kevon Looney. Heard Jeff Van Gundy say on the broadcast that Golden State team wouldn't even make the playoffs in the Western Conference. I think that's a stretch. I think it's a little disrespectful to Steph Curry and his overall talent. Steph Curry went off, but they still lost by double digits. Your reaction?
Yeah, I also thought Van Gundy maybe was laying it on a little thick with that one. I, in some ways, was impressed with Golden State last night. I don't know about you, but I thought the problem was defensively. I think they're missing Looney more than Klay right now in some regards. Obviously, they need scoring, right? I mean, Steph was a one-man offense last night. I think he was creating a lot of open shots for guys. I think the problem last night, they just couldn't defend. I mean, Toronto killed him from the three-point line. That was probably what swung the game, to be honest. I think they need to figure out their defensive rotations first and foremost. I mean, regardless of who's healthy, Boogie had a game three that I expected him to have in game two. I mean, he was a non-factor in that game. Toronto attacked him to great success. You know, before the game, I thought, does Toronto need to play Siakam at the five to kind of open up its offense? It didn't need to do that. It just needed to play its normal offense and kind of let things run its course. And that alone took advantage of Jordan Bell, DeMarcus Cousins. Steve Kerr is refusing to play Draymond at the five in this series, and I get it. I mean, they don't have a proper small ball lineup, and especially with Klay out, it's going to be tough. But if they're missing Klay and KD again, I kind of wonder at what point does he try to put Draymond at center? Because I think that's their best defensive lineup at this point.
Yeah, I want to get into what the Warriors are missing, but I was really impressed, especially in the fourth quarter, about how Toronto responded every single time the Warriors tried to get close. They never got closer than 7 points, and that was because the Raptors, with a rabid fan base around them in a hostile environment, they just answered and answered and answered. And it wasn't just one guy. I mean, Kawhi made a lot of big shots in that game, but it was a mid-range jumper from Serge Ibaka. It was a three-pointer from Kyle Lowry, who played great in that game. Huge bounce-back game for Kyle Lowry. It was Fred VanVleet knocking down a jump shot. Now, some of this you can chalk up to Klay Thompson not being there defensively to lock down a VanVleet or to lock down a Danny Green, who had another had a really strong game in this one. But I just thought the Raptors deserve a lot of credit for how they responded every time Golden State went out there and made a run. But on the other end of it, the absence of Klay Thompson offensively was so noticeable, because with Steph out there doing everything he can to will that team back into the game, he just was looking at too many bodies. Like, whoever was supposed to be guarding Klay Thompson was just turning around and going the other way and guarding Steph Curry. He was just looking at two and three guys every single time out there on the floor, and he was able to do remarkable things. But the replacement for Klay Thompson in the starting lineup, Sean Livingston, 4 points. Like, you're not going to win a lot of games when you're starting two guard, and this situation has 4 points.
Yeah, it was insane that Steph was even able to shoot as much as he did. Like, anytime he got an open look, I couldn't believe it last night, just because of the attention they had on him defensively. His aggressiveness was also creating open looks for guys like Sean Livingston, and they just couldn't hit. I don't want to downplay Toronto's performance. It was absurd, where it seemed like every single time Golden State, you know, cut it to single digits, Toronto would come back with some huge three. I will say, it just felt like Toronto, they did what they had to do, right? I mean, there was no way they could have lost this game without it being a catastrophe. It would have been, you know, frankly embarrassing for the Raptors to lose this game. Toronto should have a 3-0 lead in this series. They really should. I mean, they blew a double-digit lead at home in game two. No Kevin Durant or Klay Thompson in that fourth quarter. The Warriors scored 3 points in the final 6 minutes of a fourth quarter game two. If I'm Toronto, I'm looking at the series like, yeah, it's good that we're up 2-1. I mean, we took care of business in game three. That's a big win, but we should be up 3-0. So if I'm Toronto, I'm definitely happy, but I'm just a little less impressed with the performance, only because I couldn't even conceive of a way for them to lose this game. And yet Golden State was keeping it, like, I think, closer than I thought they would for much of the night.
So game four is Golden State's season right now. I mean, I guess if you get Durant and Thompson back for a game five, this team is capable of winning three in a row. But two of those games will be in Toronto, and they do have a finals MVP in Kawhi Leonard, who's been a closer in the past. In game four, how much pressure is on Kevin Durant to go out there and try to play? I think Klay Thompson's going to give it a go. He was this close to playing in game three. I've got my questions about how effective Klay Thompson's going to be, especially defensively, because when he's out there, they're going to go at him, no matter who's out there, just to test that hamstring and see if it's well enough to defend running off screens and playing off the dribble. So I have some questions there, but how much pressure's on Durant to get out there and give it a go in game four?
I do wonder if he doesn't play in game four and they lose, we'll kind of look back at it like, how much did he personally want this title? And that's probably an unfair thing for us to do. I don't think he's the kind of guy to slow play an injury or anything like that. I mean, he's, by all accounts, been very engaged with this team throughout this process while he's been hurt. I think there's some level of pressure on him to play, though. I mean, Toronto's good. I think Toronto's, you know, one of the better teams overall the Warriors have faced during this four-year run. They're no joke. I mean, they proved that, you know, over the first three games of this series. I think there's a decent amount of pressure on him to play, especially with Klay hobble too, especially with Looney out. I mean, the minutes are mounting on Curry. They need him. That's what it, you know, we've kind of gone over and over. You know, do the Warriors need Kevin Durant? They need him in this series, at least, for now, the way the team has looked. So I think there's definitely some pressure on him to play in game four. I'm going to be surprised if he doesn't give it a go. I just, it's been a little weird how this injury has played out. You know, it's kind of clouded. We don't know a ton about it. When it was a strained calf, I think everyone breathed a sigh of relief. Like, okay, like, we're going to see KD again. It's been a little over a month now.
May
right?
8th was the date of the injury, yeah.
Right, so it's been a full month. I'm pretty surprised that it's taken this long, but I have to imagine that he's going to do everything in his power to play in game four, because I think I agree with you. I can see the Raptors blowing a 3-1 lead if Thompson and Durant come back, but I don't think the Warriors want to put themselves in that position.
Yeah, and look, they need his offense. They need his ability to create when the offense breaks down, because you saw just how limited that team is offensively with Durant and Thompson out of the lineup. Now, DeMarcus Cousins was fantastic in game two, but I think that was more of an aberration than anything else. I mean, you can't ask a guy who's been out as long as Cousins has been out, and before that was out a significant amount of time with a different injury, to step back into an NBA Finals game and be effective. I mean, he's going up against two guys that are sharp at that point. Marc Gasol, sharp, playing good basketball. Serge Ibaka, one of the handful of guys that have been to a Finals game with the previous team, he's ready to play. It's just a lot to ask DeMarcus Cousins. You can see him out there. He just has no lift offensively. There's still some things he can do offensively, like creating offense for others with his passing. He can rebound a little bit because he's a big body. But there was a sequence in the fourth quarter where Cousins had a layup that I think would have cut the game lead to five. He missed it. On the other end, Kawhi Leonard knocked down a three. That's a five-point swing where instead of a five-point deficit, you're at 10. And that to me was devastating. Not that it's Cousins' fault. His body just won't let him do what he's capable of doing.
Yeah, I think where Durant's absence has hurt them the most is kind of what I mentioned earlier, is they can't play their best lineups. They can't shift small, and I think that's what's killing them, because I think the Warriors' front court rotation is what's a mess right now. I mean, whether it's Bell, Cousins, Bogut played well last night. I think they played Toronto even in his minutes, which is kind of incredible. The problem is Bogut's an even more of a non-factor offensively than Cousins. I mean, he's going to get some, you know, garbage points, whatever, but the defense is more or less happy to ignore Bogut. The Warriors just can't figure out who to play at center right now.
I mean, Looney's athleticism is missing.
Without a doubt.
That's a far bigger loss than people think.
Looney's a guy who they switch onto James Harden. Like, they're comfortable letting him play defensively. I think it's the center spot that is what I'm looking at for the Warriors right now. That's where they need to find an answer. I would be kind of shocked if Steve Kerr didn't at least try Draymond there for a little bit in game four. It's just something we haven't seen at all during this series. And I think that's their biggest pain point right now.
I mean, there's a lot of risk to that, because I think that the Raptors are pretty comfortable with playing Gasol against smaller guys at this point, and, you know, daring Draymond to beat them from the outside.
I agree, but they're also doing that with their other centers, right? And I just think that you give Draymond an opportunity to roam, you know, they'll live with Gasol post-ups if that's what they want for any reason. And Green's proven more than capable over the years, you know, of banging with the guys down there. I just think that solves so many problems for the Warriors, you know, playing Draymond at five. I mean, that's been the hallmark of their success.
Yeah, but they haven't done a lot of that this year. I mean, this has been one of those years where you thought they might play that death lineup a little bit more, but they've progressively gotten away from it, whereas it's become kind of a rare sighting to see it out there.
Definitely. I mean, listen, it'll be interesting. The way I've looked at it right now, it's like when Jordan Bell's out there, you're like, oh my God. When Cousins is out there, you're like, oh my God. And then, well, what other options do you have? We'll see. I wrote last night after the game, I think it might make sense to start Bogut in game four, just so you get a little bit, you know, maybe a better start defensively. Maybe Cousins. It's interesting. I was having this conversation with some other writers. Do you play Cousins with the starters to cover up his flaws, or do you play Cousins with the backup so maybe he can take advantage of Toronto's bench? Those are all tricky questions for Steve Kerr to answer. But to me, it's the center position moving forward is where the Warriors have to figure out, you know, figure that out first, and then everything else will fall into line.
But playing Cousins against the backups means you got to match him up with Ibaka, and that's a tough matchup for him because of Ibaka's athleticism and how much he's going to run the floor. I mean, he can beat Cousins up and down every single time. He can do it with Bogut as well, but Cousins especially. There are times when Cousins will pull down a rebound, and it just looks like he is, I don't know what the word is, just cringing at the idea of running up down to the other end of the floor, because he knows if he gets up there, a missed shot, he's got to come back down the other end. It's almost to the point where he's more effective rebounding than kind of casually coming up to half court. If there's something for him to get involved with, then he crosses the half court line, but you almost preserve that energy. He was right at 20 minutes last night, which is where he should be. If he has to go over that number, it's going to be a problem for Golden State.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I'm really interested to see how the lineups shake down in game four, because I do think that the front court has kind of told the story of the series through the first three games, and the Raptors look a lot stronger in that area right now. So I think that's going to be key moving forward.
All right, let's talk about some of the latest round of rumors, this time involving Kyrie Irving. Irving going to be a free agent, most likely, on July 1st, can opt out of his contract. The latest twist in Kyrie Irving is ESPN out there saying that the Nets are currently in the driver's seat.
Shout
to
out
land.
Stephen A.
Stephen A. Smith. Okay. He's putting that out there into the universe. The Nets are in the driver's seat. Danny Ainge addressed the media for the first time since the Celtics season ended, since he had that minor heart attack in the middle of the second round. When you listen to Ainge talk about Kyrie Irving, you don't get an overwhelming sense of confidence that Danny Ainge believes that Kyrie Irving is going to come back. And I reinforce that with some of the conversations I've had with people inside the Celtics organization, and there is a growing feeling that he's not going to be back. That's not to say the Celtics won't go all out to keep him. That's not to say the Celtics won't offer him a five-year full max contract. But I think, and I know, that there's a stronger sense than ever within the organization that Kyrie Irving is going to leave.
Yeah, Danny Ainge kind of sounds like someone who knows they're about to get dumped, where he's like, it was worth it. I would do it all over again. Yeah.
Well, that's,
no problem.
Let me just hit you on that, too, because it was worth it. Because really all they gave up was Colin Sexton. Like the rights to draft somebody there.
No. I don't disagree. It's just funny. I don't disagree with you there. Yeah, man. This is what I've been saying ever since Kyrie said before the season, I'm going to resign with the Celtics. This is all I have to say about Kyrie Irving. Just don't listen to this man, okay? Don't listen to this man. Just wait till he signs his name on a piece of paper before trying to make sense of any of his decisions. I think who knows what he wants to do. In some ways, I kind of give him credit for being able to have this shroud of mystery over what it is that he actually wants to do. It's kind of funny if you think about it. LeBron James going to the Lakers, how long was that a rumor for? I think it was not quite an open secret, but it was something people kind of expected. Then what does he do? He signs with the Lakers. Kevin Durant, and people would be shocked if he didn't sign with the Knicks at this point, right? But then you have Kyrie Irving. No one in the world, it seemingly, knows what this man wants to do. Not the Celtics. I mean, the Nets, that would be kind of weird, right? I mean, especially like the way D'Angelo Russell came on at the end of last season. It's just going to be interesting. I'd be kind of surprised if Sean Marks, after carefully building all this space and doing all he's had the last couple years to kind of put this team on the precipice of being great, decides to hand the keys over to Kyrie Irving after what just happened with the Celtics last year. If I'm following this Kyrie thing, listen, I'm just waiting until he signs his name on a piece of paper before trying to make sense of any of his decisions. I think the Celtics should have felt this way for a year, and I know that's easy for me to say on the outside looking in. I mean, they were with him every day. He had made these public proclamations, but this is just this is what Kyrie has been for years now. He's a guy who wanted to request a trade from the Cavs after hitting the game-winning shot in the finals. So I don't think this should be a surprise that the way things ended, the way his playoff performance went, that, you know, maybe he's looking elsewhere.
The Nets don't make a lot of sense to me because they're like the slimmed down version of the team he just left, right? I mean, it would make sense geographically because he's from that North Jersey area. There are ties, obviously, to New York. But the Nets are a good up-and-coming young team. The Celtics were, I don't want to say a great young team, but a much better young team in terms of the talent that they had in the roster. Why would Kyrie Irving trade one young team for another, especially when you'd be joining a backcourt with D'Angelo Russell, and I'm not sure how those two play together.
Oh, like, they can't. I mean, I think that would be a disaster defensively.
So you would let Russell walk if you signed Kyrie Irving?
I think so.
Then what are you then at that point? Like, I don't know what team is.
And then you try to get another guy. Maybe you go after like Tobias or Jimmy. I don't know what it is. Here's what I'll say. The reason why I think Kyrie would do that is because I think maybe he feels like, oh, maybe I'd have a better chance molding these young guys than I did with the Celtics. I wonder if the worst thing that happened to Boston in retrospect was them making the Eastern Conference Finals without Kyrie Irving. Did that kind of set into motion what happened this season, where they just had a year-long friction between the way Kyrie wanted the team to run and the way the young guys wanted the team to run? And I don't know whose side I fall on in that argument because, I mean, Kyrie is a point, hey, I've won a championship before, and I've hit the shots. I know what it takes. The young guys are like, hey, man, listen, we can do this without you. We pushed LeBron to a game 7 without you. In some ways, that almost set the stage for everything that happened this season, that Eastern Conference Finals run. So if Kyrie does want to leave, I wonder, again, how much of it is he maybe didn't have the control he wanted in Boston that he thought he was going to have when he was quote-unquote getting his own team.
Yeah, I mean,
of course that all goes out the window if he signs with the Lakers, right? I mean, who knows what he wants?
Right. I think that, you know, not to relitigate Boston's season, but making the conference finals and getting within, coming within minutes of making the NBA finals, it was problematic mostly in that these guys felt that they deserved big roles, and that when Kyrie and Gordon Hayward came back, those roles were diminished. They all said the right thing coming into the season, but I've always said and I've always written, sacrifice is an easy thing to say and it's a hard thing to do. Ask anybody that's ever had to do it over the course of their careers. Chris Bosh struggled with it when he was first in Miami. Kevin Love struggled with it when he was paired with LeBron in Cleveland. Guys like Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, who were terrific in the 2018 playoffs, they just never quite adapted to the new reality with Kyrie and Gordon Hayward. And Terry Rozier had it even worse because he was asked to go from a 35-minute per game point starting point guard to a combo guard, you know, getting minutes sporadically off the bench. I wonder, I mean, not that it necessarily matters or that Kyrie cares, but how much of his reputation takes a hit if he winds up leaving Boston to go somewhere else? Now, the Lakers would be just bizarre. Like, he would leave LeBron 2 years later, go back to the exact same role he had before, realize, like, maybe that's what I want. Maybe I just want to be a baller. Maybe I don't want to be a leader. Maybe I don't want my own team. How much of Kyrie's rep would take a hit if he left Boston, this is the final chapter in Kyrie Irving with the Celtics?
I don't know that his reputation would take a hit, if only because, you know, the mastery of whatever Kyrie has done, you know, publicly over the last few years is kind of given him cover to make a decision like this. I mean, his whole public persona is, you'll never understand me. I mean, that's kind of what he's going for. So in that sense, I don't think the conversation about Kyrie has ever been the conversation we have around guys like Anthony Davis, guys like Kevin Durant, guys like LeBron James. I think Kyrie is in like a tier below those guys. And I think what he wants at all times seemingly is to defy convention. So if that means leaving the Celtics for the Nets, or if that means leaving the Celtics for the Lakers, somehow all these options fit into his personality. So I just don't know that he's ever really been judged the way other superstars get judged. And I feel like he's just going to find a way to spin it, you know, into his, you know, his narrative, so to speak. So I don't know that his reputation is going to take a hit. And again, he is like these other guys this summer, whether it's Kawhi, whether it's KD, who've kind of in some ways earned the right. I mean, they've always had the right. They've kind of earned the, I don't know what the word is for this, but he's won a championship before. We've seen him on the big stage. We've seen him have huge games in the finals. He's kind of above, you know, the typical legacy chasing that we sometimes expect guys to do in this situation. So I don't know that his reputation takes a hit, if only because his reputation is so just mysterious to begin with.
I would say, though, you don't put Kyrie Irving, or he shouldn't want to go back into another situation where he'd have to be a leader, because I don't think he's cut out for traditional leadership. I mean, it's hard. Like, there's only a handful of guys in the league that you can say are really good at it. LeBron is certainly, or has been, great at it over his career. I think Kawhi, in his own way, is pretty good at it. A lead by example type of guys who always has the respect of his teammates.
Boardman gets paid.
Great hat tip to the Athletic there with a great story on Kawhi Leonard. I just think if he leaves Boston, it's got to be for a role where he's just a basketball player. Whether it's playing with Kevin Durant and Durant's the leader, whether it's playing with LeBron and LeBron's the leader. If he goes to Brooklyn and it's just them in Brooklyn, that's not going to work.
The Nets should not do that.
His leadership is just, it's just not there. Like, he didn't have it all year long. It was paint by numbers with Kyrie, trying this thing. Let's try leading this way. Let's try leading that way. None of it worked, and he never looked comfortable in that role. So that's the big thing, big takeaway for me. If he leaves Boston, he's got to go to another situation that's completely different. He can't go into a similar type situation and expect it to work. The other thing about the Celtics, and one thing I thought was interesting, from what I've been able to learn, if Kyrie Irving walks, it is not going to diminish their appetite to go get Anthony Davis.
That's interesting.
They are still, I think, going to be aggressive with Davis. Now, I don't know what that means, whether it means they would include Jason Tatum in a Davis deal, But from what I understand, they're not going to take their foot off the gas when it comes to pursuing Anthony Davis. And now that would be a real risk because, like we said, Kyrie, not a massive risk given that Isaiah Thomas was never the same player and that the eighth pick in the draft, whatever. What are we going to get for it that would really make you regret making a deal like that? But Anthony Davis is different. Anthony Davis is going to require a glut of assets, at least enough to outbid the Lakers and the Knicks and some of these other teams that are going to get in the Davis bidding. What do you think of the idea of the Celtics still going all in for Davis if Kyrie walks?
I like the idea of teams taking risks on superstars. We saw Toronto do it with Kawhi, obviously. We saw the Thunder do it with Paul George. I think that should be any team's blueprint in going after Anthony Davis. If you want a superstar like him, go get him and prove to them that your culture is worth keeping a player like that around. So I think it would make sense. I don't know that I'm not maybe as high on Tatum as some people are. I think he's very good. This season was definitely a little bit of a step back. But I don't know that I would get rid of him and all your young assets for Anthony Davis, only because then you run the risk a little bit of kind of running back to him what the Pelicans have had the last couple of years, which is just, you know, him on a team with not a lot of support around him. So what I will say about the Celtics is I think more teams should put themselves in the Anthony Davis conversation and be less freaked out by the 1 year he has left and instead think, let's bring this guy in and see what we can do and have some faith in our organizational structure that he'd want to stay.
I don't think I would do it if I was Boston, because if Davis walks, then everything you've accomplished with those Nets trades or that Nets trade is gone. You know,
yeah, that's fair.
You'd probably have to give up Tatum. Maybe it's Tatum and Brown.
It's Tatum and Brown, that's going to be tough. I don't know that I would do that.
That's a tough, even if it's just one of those two guys, you just, everything would evaporate off what you did with that Nets deal. That being said, I do know that there is some regret from some people within the Celtics organization about not pulling the trigger on a Kawhi Leonard deal last summer.
A lot of teams should regret that.
Well, the Celtics, though, I mean, it was pretty, like, they could have made a deal for Kawhi Leonard, my understanding from kind of both sides of this, involving Jaylen Brown and Marcus Smart, or Jaylen Brown is the centerpiece of it all. They didn't do it, in part because I don't think they wanted to tie themselves to two players that are going to be unrestricted free agents the summer 19. At that time, they had no idea what Kyrie was going to do. But think about what the Celtics would be with Kawhi and Kyrie on that team, like the kind of force they would be on both ends of the floor. Because one thing Kyrie has done this season, like Kyrie's coming off maybe his best season as a player. Like he had a great basketball season. It was kind of tarnished by what he was off the court, but he had a great season as a basketball player. I think there's some significant regret within the organization in Boston about not rolling the dice to go get Kawhi Leonard.
The Sixers, like, what if they had put Mark, like, did they even offer Markelle Fultz to the Spurs?
I don't know, but I'm not sure why that, I mean, at that point.
No, I mean, before the season? Before, I mean, that kind of maybe.
Yeah, but I think the word was kind of out on Markelle Fultz for.
Can I run you my sleeper team for Anthony Davis?
Okay.
So I know you're boys with Tim Connelly. So if you could just run this one up the ladder for me, okay? See what he thinks.
Boys with Tim Connelly.
I tried to get Tim Connelly to let me make a trade phone call for him when I did a story on the Nuggets, and he made a very funny joke that I probably shouldn't repeat, but cool guy, all right? So I know that he doesn't mind listening to trade offers. The Nuggets should go after Anthony Davis. That's my sleeper team for Anthony Davis. Now, it would require a lot. And here's a little fake trade I've been playing with, okay? And honestly, this might even be too steep for Denver. But what if you gave them Jamal Murray, Gary Harris, and Michael Porter Jr. for Anthony Davis? Now, here's why I think that could maybe work for both sides, okay? You talk about all the guys who've been bandied about for Anthony Davis. You could argue Jamal Murray has the most accomplished of any of those prospects that people have talked about for Anthony Davis. He's only 22. He flashed a lot of potential in the playoffs. You know, Steve Kerr was comparing him to Steph Curry in the New York Times this week. Jamal Murray is very good. Gary Harris, I think, is one of the most underrated players in the league. He's a guy you can play in the playoffs and not worry for a second that he's going to take anything off the floor. I mean, great shooter, great defender. You know, Michael Porter Jr., a guy who could have been a top five pick without his injury issues, a great prospect. If you're the Pelicans, I mean, that really kickstarts your rebuild. You're almost building a little bit of like a Bayou Nugget situation, Zion Williamson, Jamal Murray, Gary Harris. You then have Drew Holiday, someone you can keep around, maybe trade him for more young pieces. So I think it makes some sense for the Pelicans. The Nuggets, do you make such a risky trade when you have a young core, you know, one that was already second in the West and could be a title contender just by virtue of the Warriors breaking up next year? It's a risky move for them. But, I mean, you put AD and Jokic together in the front court. AD is the exact kind of player who can kind of cover for Jokic's, you know, defensive issues. And then you probably have the most talented offensive front court in the league right there. Monte Morris is someone who I think can step into the starting lineup. You still have Will Barton. If Paul Millsap walks, you might have some free agent money to play with. If I'm the Nuggets, I would just think about it. I mean, how often has your franchise been in a position to get someone of that talent on your roster? So just run that one by Tim and tell me what he thinks.
Well, I think they've got some flexibility, I believe, with the Paul Millsap contract. I think it's a team option.
That's right. So the issue with Millsap is I think if they don't make any major moves, they need him back. I think he's a very underrated part of that team.
Right. The Nuggets are always going to be an interesting team to look at because they do have a wealth of young talent and they've got a super aggressive front office. Now, last summer, and I wrote this at the time, the Nuggets were frantically trying to get a meeting with LeBron James. Like, they wanted to sell him on a front court with Jokic, which they viewed as one of, if not the best passing front courts in NBA history, with those two guys at the five and the four, and throw in Jamal Murray as the point guard. They thought that was the type of team that could get to the NBA Finals. The problem with your deal is that as much as I think they would love to get their hands on Anthony Davis, Murray's always been viewed as a guy to them as almost untouchable. Like, and maybe it certainly differs if you're talking about Davis, but when they were talking about clearing the cap space needed to get LeBron, because they would need to move some pieces around to make that happen last summer, it was move a Gary Harris. Mm-hmm. It was move a Paul Millsap. It was never, they love Jamal Murray. And
look, I don't blame them.
And they're the type of team that I'm sure would consider that type of move. But it's a lot to ask. If you've got to really gut your roster for a guy that you have no guarantees of keeping after the year. Now, things have changed across the NBA. What Paul George did, what Kawhi Leonard might do. You know, it has emboldened teams for sure to think that way. But when you've got a team that good, I'm not sure you break it up, you know, to go get an Anthony Davis with no guarantees.
Can I just one more thing about the Nuggets? And I'm in the tank for this team. I really like them. I love watching them. They're probably my favorite team to watch in the NBA. Something that Tim Connelly said this summer, I think, rings true, and I hope NBA players actually took notice of. He made a great point. He said, if you're a player who's really about winning, why aren't you considering the Denver Nuggets? And I could not agree more. If you're LeBron James and you're really about winning, I understand you're LeBron. Maybe you don't want to live in Denver, whatever.
By the way, who wouldn't want to live in Denver?
Denver's a great town.
Great
My
city.
High school principal is moving to Denver. Shout out Mr. Ramirez.
Okay, that was unnecessary.
But yes,
we're editing that out.
Denver's a great city. I got very high in Denver. I had a lovely time. We're keeping both those things in.
We're definitely keeping that in.
But here's the thing. If you're a player that's about winning, why wouldn't you want to go to Denver? I mean, they have an amazing young core, aggressive, great front office, an awesome city. And there's like a glaring hole for a small forward size superstar to slide into that starting lineup. And they would just run away with the West with someone like LeBron or Kevin Durant, even Paul George. Like, he would be incredible in Denver. So I really hope free agents, stars around the league are taking notice of the Nuggets, because that is such a good team and such a good front office. It bothers me that people don't want to sign there, because they have the potential to be outstanding, you know, very soon.
Well, I think that the vibe on them, or the perception on them, certainly has changed after this year. I mean, last year they were just on the outside looking in of the playoffs, last game of the season. This year they run up to that number two seed. Didn't end the way they wanted to end, but I do think the perception has changed now that they've proven they could win at least on a regular season level. But I think the way they improve is via trade and packaging some of those young pieces but you've got great young pieces there. Like, you know, they've done a hell of a job mining the back end of the first round, the second round, undrafted free agents to flesh out that roster. And, you know, that's going to be tough to give up. The other part of it is a lot of these guys are going to start costing them some real money down the line, and it's going to blow up that payroll to another level. All right, let me finish with some Lakers stuff here, because the Lakers right now, how they're handling their coaching staff is interesting, to say the least. Lionel Hollins, the latest coach to join Frank Vogel's staff there, and the Lakers just seem to be content fleshing this roster out, or this coaching staff out, with ex-head coaches. You got Jason Kidd as the de facto lead assistant. Now you bring in Lionel Hollins. They're treating Frank Vogel like he's a rookie coach that needs these coaches supplementing him. They're treating him like, say, he's John Beilein in Cleveland, who is a longtime college coach but has no experience as an NBA head coach. Frank Vogel was a highly successful NBA coach for 5.5 seasons in Indiana.
He was the biggest thorn in LeBron's side.
He was. I don't understand the thinking behind, you know, Jason Kidd. They've clearly got a strong feeling towards, and I think it's fair to wonder if he's the coach in waiting. But now you add Lionel Hollins to the mix. What do you make of the latest coaching add to the Lakers staff?
I mean, on one hand, I kind of understand when you have LeBron, you kind of, he's, what has he always loved? He loves veterans around him, right? Maybe you get veterans on the coaching staff too, guys he can kind of connect with. The problem with the Lakers just comes down to the process of their decision making, again, even more so than the actual decisions they've made. What is the rhyme or reason anything's going on there? I've said this time and time again on this podcast. I've written it. We've talked about it on Crossover TV. Why is Rob Pelinka in charge of the Lakers? The people who have the most power in Los Angeles right now are like Rob Pelinka, Kurt and Linda Rambis. It's just, it's an amateur operation. Like, it's mind-blowing to me that these are the people running the franchise. And I think that is what kind of, it just comes down to me. It bothers me more the people making the decisions than the actual decisions themselves. I think Lionel Hollins maybe can bring, you know, again, just some veteran insight to the staff. Maybe he helps, you know, Frank Vogel to just, you know, bounce ideas off of. I'm sure there are going to be times this season when Vogel is stressed, you know, kind of in over his head, whatever, whatever, that I think it'll help to have, you know, kind of other guys there with experience to calm him down. But the Hollins thing doesn't bother as much as the fact that they just haven't addressed kind of the issues they have in the front office.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're going to spend probably a lot of time in the next year discussing the Lakers front office and the dynamic there and how it all works, especially this offseason when they've got to do something productive to improve that roster. But I'm actually, at this point, I'm okay with Rob Pelinka being in charge as long as he's in charge. You know, he's the only one there with qualifications for that job. I mean, Linda Rambis.
And those are loose.
They're loose, but look, he's a longtime agent. And again, I mean, there's been some questions about how Pelinka and Magic Johnson went about the draft process, but the reality is they drafted pretty well. I mean, the fixation on Lonzo Ball aside, Kuzma, Josh Hart, I mean, if we're going to criticize Pelinka for everything they did involving free agency and how they constructed the roster around LeBron James, we've got to give him credit for how they drafted there. You can't say he screwed this up and then somebody else got this right. It just doesn't work that way in the NBA. My biggest concern has been twofold. One, Pelinka is not the guy with final say on basketball operations decisions. And two, when the going gets tough, Frank Vogel doesn't get the support that he needs. Now you have three head coaches and two guys in Hollins and Jason Kidd who have not been shy about saying they want to be head coaches once again. How does that work? When it gets to be a tough patch, does everyone kind of go to their corners and say, like, does everybody have their own little factions inside the locker room? Does Lionel Hollins befriend the younger guys in that locker room? Does Jason Kidd go to LeBron, his former USA basketball teammate, and a guy he's had a close relationship? How does Frank Vogel marshal all these guys together to create a harmonious situation? Because no matter what happens this offseason, let's say best case scenario, they get Anthony Davis from New Orleans. there's still going to be bumps in the road as you try to incorporate Anthony Davis and add more pieces to a roster that is going to be decimated because you had to go out and get Anthony Davis. How does all that, how do you keep the ship together when it seems like everyone coming in is going to have their own agenda?
The like Hindenburg potential is very high. I feel like if you close your eyes, you can already kind of picture the Brian Windhorst or Kevin Arnovitz, you know, February story about how everyone inside the Lakers is warring. I mean, whose side is Rich Paul going to take? Like, who's he going to complain to Adam Silver about this time? Or is he going to go up to Adam Silver and be like, you know, I really think Jason Kidd should have been coaching this team the whole time.
The fascination with Jason Kidd is it eludes me.
Weird. I mean, look at how much better the team he just coached was without him.
And look, Jason did do a really good job with Giannis's player development. He put the ball in his hands at a time you needed to expand his game. And Jason and his staff, Sean Sweeney was the guy assigned to Giannis for a number of years. They worked hard on improving his jump shot. It's just not there yet. Like, it's his form isn't bad. It's just not consistently there. So I'll give him credit for player development, but from an X's and O's perspective, you're not going to find too many scouts that'll say that Jason Kidd coached teams were among the better ones in the league.
Yeah, it's really disappointing, man. I can't even put a dollar amount on what I would pay to know LeBron James's true thoughts about all of this, because I just can't imagine he's happy. I can't imagine he wants to play for Frank Vogel. I can't imagine that he loves that Rob Pelinka and Kurt and Linda Rambis are kind of running the ship here. I mean, wouldn't you rather almost have Rich Paul in charge than those people? There's just so much potential for disaster here. And this summer is massively important. Like, for them to be running this loose of a ship when this summer is going to determine, you know, the twilight of LeBron's career and probably determine how LeBron's Lakers tenure is remembered is just insane to me. The disaster potential is so high here. This is like ultimate boom or bust for the Lakers. Because like you said, there is like a chance they somehow end up with Anthony Davis and Kyrie Irving and they roll out far and away the best team on paper heading into next season. There's also a chance they end up with like Kemba Walker and I don't even know who else. LeBron misses 30 games and we're just like, you know, what went wrong halfway through the season? There's almost no middle ground for this team. At this point, it's incredible boom or incredible bust.
Yeah, my prediction on the first tough call for the Laker front office is it's going to involve Bradley Beal, because I think based on what you know, I feel like I've know right now, it's going to be incredibly tough for them to get Anthony Davis. It's going to be a long shot that they land Kyrie Irving. When the dust settles on the Wizards GM search, which is a whole separate topic, by the way, that the Wizards are still without a full-time GM.
I'll do
GM.
It, Washington. Like Ernie Grunfeld, I'll
I
do
mean,
it.
Just make Tommy Shepard the GM. I know that, you know, the perception in Washington is that it's the same as it was with Ernie, but Tommy's his own man, and Tommy disagreed with Ernie on a bunch of stuff over the years. He's a worker. He's been around. He's got the respect of players and agents across the league. Just make Tommy Shepard the GM. Anyway, when the dust settles on that, I think the Wizards, understanding the likelihood that John Wall is ever the same player, is not great, and certainly next year he's not either not going to be back or not going to be close to what he once was. I think they'll explore dealing Bradley Beal, and if you're the Lakers, you got to be careful not to give up the farm in a deal like that, because Bradley Beal is a great player, but he's not an Anthony Davis type of player. So you don't make the same kind of absurd offer to go get Davis. They've got to make sure that if they make a deal for Bradley Beal, which I think is very much possible in Los Angeles, that they don't give up everybody to go and get him, because the Wizards, with an experienced staff, could get over on them pretty easily.
And one thing I'll just kind of say real quick, as much as I'm like, you know, giving the Lakers grief right now, one thing that's going to be really interesting next season is how different title contenders look.
Yep.
Once the Warriors break up, like we kind of assume, because that could really kind of change everything in terms of how we perceive teams and who their top two guys are.
I agree. Rohan, always appreciate it. I'm sure we'll be here in this room next week, because we're never getting out of this.
That's right.
Room.
Yeah. People are going to make fun of us now because we're not going to be able to get out. They're going to take photos of us locked in this room together, which I'm sure people will see on our Instagram.
I've already sent the SOS text to a couple of people in the office to open the door immediately. Thanks, Rohan.